Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Clayton Charteris, who is Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Toronto, about Under the Cover, the Creation, Production, and Reception of a Novel. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a great book. I mean, I have a vested interest because it's kind of deals with a load of stuff I'm interested in. But just in general, I found it, you know, really interesting, really easy to read, and a really kind of straightforward introduction to both a lot of sociological theory and the publishing industry as well. So kind of well done on the book.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, it was a massive struggle trying to make a readable book that had something to say to other sociologists as well.
And yeah, I mean, that would be quite an interesting place to start with, I think. You know, if you could tell me a bit about the kind of the process of developing the book and where it kind of fits in with, I guess, your sort of broader academic project, dare I say it.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think like most authors, I really just oriented towards trying to write a book I wanted to read and that I wish existed and didn't exist. I think after you're in the academic game for a little while, the world starts to feel really small and you realize, oh, wait, if I don't do this thing, it might not get done. Where I think is when you're younger, you're always afraid that everybody's doing the same thing you're doing. So in my life, it's like background stories of like how things get made that have always excited me. When DVD commentaries first came out, I found myself listening to the director commentaries and not even watching the movies. So I really wanted to get behind the scenes of something all the way from start to finish. It wasn't an intellectual idea at first. It was just something I love and something I always want to read. So the book really came about that way.
And you concentrate on this one book, Jarrett's Fill by Cornelia Nixon. And I mean, we can't really say anything about Under the Cover without knowing a bit about both Cornelia as the author and also Jarrett's little book. And I guess one route into that is maybe to think about her in terms of her social location and the idea of her being a kind of individual author. And one of the things that the book does is balance that kind of the sense of her as a, you know, as an individual author who's talented with her kind of social location and the broader social context that gives rise to her writing.
Sure. Yeah. So Cornelia Nixon, Jarrettsville came out in 2009. It was her third work of literary fiction, or what she had intended to be received as a work of literary fiction. She is a professor first English and then an MFA program, which has a huge effect on the fact that she's even a novelist at all. So part of her social location is this massive rise in MFA programs in the United States, really starting in the 1970s as a form of indirect government intervention in the United States. Unlike Western Europe or in Canada, where artists are still largely funded directly from the government, because of conservative censure in the United States, the government had to figure out a way to hide money to working novelists. And they did so through really providing the seed grants by coaxing universities into applying for seed grants to fund MFA programs. So Cornelia Nixon, like, takes a decade to write a novel, and she really couldn't do that without this indirect governmental subsidy. In terms of her writing and world as a novelist, like most novelists, I think we tend to think of writing as something that's done alone. Just in the general world, it's because we don't see novelists. When we see two people walking down the street, talking to each other. We don't say, oh, that might be two novelists and they're collaboratively creating to solve a problem with their novel. It's just hard to observe those things. So while Cornelia Nixon financially is able to afford to be a writer because of the time and place she's writing in, like all novelists, she really creates collaboratively in these groups that take place over the phone or behind the closed doors of private homes. So the phrase she used to describe her writing life is it's just really a series of friends saving her from herself, really creating collaboratively together.
In some kind of fascinating, you know, urban settings as well. Like, you know, there's a lot of discussion of the Starbucks and, you know, this kind of stuff. And I think we'll kind of get into that as we get into the story of the book. But one thing you kind of gestured towards, you know, friends sort of saving her from herself, points really clearly to the kind of social nature of artistic or authorial, if that's a word, creativity. And I guess this is a moment where we can link directly to some of the more theoretical work that goes on in the book. And I guess the big question there is the idea of a field. And the book draws on this idea about fields of creation, fields of production, fields of reception, you know, art, commerce, and meaning. And I guess, defining what a field is and thinking about these three fields that are crucial to the book would be really useful.
Sure. So, you know, field, even for Tony academics, fields are kind of muddy concepts and end up being kind of tautological. But I think the best way to describe it is if you think of any setting or type of social arrangement in which everybody in it is kind of orienting towards the same thing, they kind of have the same taken for granted reality, and they're positioning against each other, that would be a field. So if there's the same commonsensical ideas about the way things go, what's good or what's bad. So for authors, we kind of know authors live in a field because they think about themselves in relationship to other authors. When they say everybody, they of course don't mean everybody in the world, and they don't mean publishers and they don't mean readers. Everybody for them means other authors. Right. And they're thinking about their lives and thinking about their creation in relation to what other authors are doing. So an example I use in the book is the status of Marion Ettlinger. We can really tell that these are different fields because of the relationship to this woman named Marion Ettlinger. And Marion Ettlinger and who she is means an entirely different thing to authors than it does to book publishers, than it does to readers. And we'll start with the easy one. To readers, the name Marion Ettlinger means probably nothing. It's entirely meaningless. And who Marion Ettlinger is she is a very famous author photographer. So she is the most high status person to have take the author picture of the author in the back of the book. So for authors, it's even a verb to be Ettlingered. And to be Ettlingered is to signal that you're very high status in the field. You have arrived. You are not to be trifled with. So authors notice all the time if somebody has been Ettlingered or not. And that's a very meaningful thing. Often this different field of publishers, they know who Marion Ettlinger is because oftentimes they have to pay for the photo, but it's just vanity on the part of the author. They find it ridiculous. They would never tell an author that they think it's silly, but they kind of backbite and make jokes about authors requesting to be Ettlingered, and it doesn't serve any purpose in the world of publishing in the world they live in. They really just pay for Ettlinger photos as a gift to their authors. So we kind of know, just through the example of Marion Ettlinger, she's a photo by her is deeply meaningful in this field among authors. It doesn't really mean anything, and it's just kind of a joke in the field of publishers and among readers. Marion Ettlinger might as well not exist at all. Her existence is totally unobservable to us.
What's useful about that example, I think, is the complementarity or the maybe the kind of lack of antagonism that you've drawn across those three fields. In the kind of classic discussion of cultural fields, there's always a sense that, you know, commerce, meaning, creation, art are somehow in tension. And, you know, we can debate the minutiae of budget, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. But I really like actually the way that you sort of position these three fields as actually complementary of each other. That, you know, in that example, the public might see that particular photograph, be able to recognize that this person must be an author because they kind of look like that. Publishers, yeah, you know, see it as a kind of a bit of a chore, or a bit, you know, a bit of a joke or an obligation. And for authors, it has that kind of moment of, I've arrived, I'm a real author now, you know. And in that sense, you know, it's not a set of antagonisms, it's actually a set of compliments.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. And I'm really glad you noted that. You know, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in the way that when people do characterize the relationship between fields, which I really, we don't do enough, they tend to think of them as antagonistic, or they focus on the sparks and bomb moments where something happens somewhere outside of a field and everything changes within it. But in day-to-day life, these are three arenas of social life, which is just a less fancy way to say field, that are really highly interdependent on each other. So most of the time, things are functioning well. It's almost exceptional when things kind of break down between these fields. And when they do break down, everybody is scrambling to get them back in balance because everybody needs each other, right? Publishers can't publish without authors or readers. Readers can't read without authors or publishers, using broadly, because of self-publishing, of course.
it's interesting that that kind of comment about self-publishing, because one of the kind of, almost the kind of great myths that happens because of the interaction of fields is the idea of author having a particular kind of status. We've got on the one hand discussions about the idea that, well, anybody could be an author. You know, you can self-publish, you can put something up on Amazon for whatever it is, you know, a dollar or a pound, and, you know, that might go viral and, you know, you might be the next big thing. Or, you know, well, if you've got a Random House or a Penguin or something, then somehow you've got a particular social status. But in actual fact, what's going on here is an arena where there's not actually a lot of money to be made. And, you know, what's really going on actually is a mismatch between the economic and perhaps the, you know, the cultural or the social. And I think you nail this down with this lovely chapter title, which I ended up tweeting about because I liked it so much, How $6,000 Becomes a Middle-Class Income. And I wonder if you could kind of tell that story, actually, you know, that kind of tension between being an author but also basically never getting paid.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the starting place here is that throughout history, almost, you know, authors are almost exclusively limited to two types of people. And that's people with multi-generational wealth and people with a spouse or partner that makes enough income that allows them to be authors, right? So this isn't about the ability to write or the ability to be creative. It's about the ability to pay one's rent while writing, right? Going back into this transition, we really, in the humanities, social scientists haven't noticed this because we don't really study the lives of creatives as much as we should. We tend to overemphasize industry and production. So right under our noses, we've had this massive sea change in how artists earn incomes and earn livings. My friend Alison Gerber has a new book that's coming out right now on fine artists. And she makes the same argument. We've been making this argument together. We really live in what in the humanities people call the program era. And by the program era, what they mean is the rise of teaching and fine arts programs as a way to make a living while being an artist and while being an author. That's really, it's dramatically changed the lives of authors, the lives of poets, the lives of fine artists and dancers. And comparatively, it's actually authors work less in teaching than people in other arts. So fine artists and dancers and actors work, generate much more of their income from teaching than do novelists. But still, the majority of novelists in the United States today, I think about 59%, have or currently work as teachers as a way to generate income.
I mean, that, yeah, it is paralleled by lots of other research that's been going on, for example, over here in the UK. And it's interesting because it tells us something about not just, I suppose, the kind of financial model for authorship, and, you know, we'll discuss that a bit more in turn, but also it tells us something again about social location and the impact on the work itself. And I suppose if we return to the book, it's interesting how the book itself sort of straddles that, you know, coming from at least the impression I get in your narrative of it, it's quite a kind of academic context, you know, with the reading group and the MFA and discussions of how, you know, first person or evil characters, you know, should be kind of located versus the demands of, you know, how can we sell this as a sort of literary slash historical novel? And I wonder, you know, what the title itself might tell us about. And the second chapter, you know, has got this thing about how the book ended up being called what it's called. And I wonder if you could sort of tell that story as a as an illustration of these different worlds that it crosses.
Sure. Yeah. So the book was not always titled Jarrettsville. And just to give a brief backstory of what Jarrettsville is. So Jarrettsville is a historical fiction novel that covers a true story from Cornelia Nixon's family history. And what that story is that in postbellum Jarrettsville, Maryland, so immediately following the Civil War in Jarrettsville, which is 2 or 3 miles south of the Mason-Dixon line, which was the dividing line of the North and South in the Civil War, one of Cornelia Nixon's ancestors, Martha Jane Cairns, was from a Southern supporting family and ended up in a relationship with a man from a Union family with an abolitionist preacher father. She becomes pregnant, they break up, and then Martha Jane Cairns shoots Nicholas McComas multiple times in the chest in front of 50 eyewitnesses and essentially murders him on a parade a few years later celebrating the Confederate surrender. And ultimately what happens, so this story was front page news in the New York Times at the time. It ended up being covered in Ripley's Believe It or Not throughout the 1950s and then was kind of forgotten about. But ultimately, Martha Jane Cairns is found innocent on these very made up grounds of what in the trial was termed justifiable homicide. So Cornelia Nixon really was a literary fiction author who was winning a bunch of literary awards, really well respected among her peer authors, but nobody had ever heard of her. Her books weren't selling. So she thought of Jarrettsville, this is in her terminology, as her ace in the hole. It was her chance to finally find an audience for her writing that had been well-loved by famous reviewers and well-respected by other novelists, but she didn't have actually readers. So when she was writing Jarrettsville, she had this kind of competing, it wasn't quite a tension, but an awareness that, like, this is my blockbuster. This is my chance to achieve true popularity. So her first draft of Jarrettsville, the entire novel is told from Martha's perspective, right? The perspective of the eventual murderer. And it was titled Martha's Version. What happened is her literary agent sent it out to about 20 different publishers. It was rejected by all of them. Cornelia Nixon dug back into her rejection letters and from those rejection letters realized that the story didn't work because nobody understood Nick's motivations, right? Nick just came off as some type of cad. So she went back and rewrote. She rewrote the novel so that now in its final form, or I would say in the second draft of the novel, the first third is told from Martha's perspective. The second third is told from Nick's perspective. And the final third of the novel, she wrote from the perspective of multiple characters of the town. At this point, she realized she needed a new title because it wasn't Martha's Version anymore. So she wrote out a list of about 15 titles and took it to a writing group, hoping that they could help her pick which title she should use for the novel. And instead, you know, it's that classic example of them saving her from herself. They essentially said, Cornelia, we love you, but all of these titles suck. These are awful titles for your novel. And somebody in the room had suggested, how about just Jarrettsville, right? This isn't a story about a relationship between two people. It's not just that, but it's also a story about a place and a time and a town. And Jarrettsville is a really appropriate title. And she ended up going with it. There was still one more change Jarrettsville had to make, which is the press that did accept Jarrettsville at that point it's a literary imprint. It's an independent press, but has a well-held reputation for literary fiction. So the accepting editor for the novel was very worried reading the first section by Martha. His major concern was this might be confused for a romance novel. The euphemism he used was it was so sunny. It's so sunny and optimistic. Readers might think this is a romance novel. They might be blindsided that a murder happens. And Counterpoint Press, the publisher that published it, they can't publish romance fiction. It would hurt their literary reputation. They just don't know what to do with romance fiction. They don't have any connections to the romance fiction world or to promote a romance fiction novel. So his solution to that problem was to take the immediate aftermath of the murder, as told by other characters in the story, and essentially cut that from 2/3 of the way through the book and move it up to the front to tell the story out of order. And what that did was to clarify to readers from page one that, like, a murder is going to take place. This is not a romance novel. You know, if you love romance novels, you'll probably be pretty disappointed in this book. And it also introduced this complexity of form. So it made the novel more literary in a sense as well. It got the novel back in balance between Cornelia Nixon's aspirations to be a popular novelist, but also a novelist with a literary reputation. Sorry for the long answer, but that's what's going on in there.
No, but it shows so clearly the social structures around this novel. And, you know, it sort of, on the one hand, punctures narratives of authorial intention or genius, but also points us towards the need for a sociological analysis. And I guess there's maybe, you know, we might think about three bits of immediate analysis in the field of production. So there's the transition with the literary agent, there's the role of the editor, and then there's how the industry is structured in terms of how, you know, books are delivered to stores and order runs and stuff like this. And I wonder if you could sketch, you know, broadly what in part three of the book you call the field of production surrounding the book.
Yeah, you know, so you're absolutely right. So, you know, the first thing is the transition in the literary agent. And, you know, one of the things I was really interested in is if these are different fields, if authors are off in their own world and publishers are off in their own world, how do things get from here to there? And the answer is literary agents, who I think traditionally get treated as gatekeepers, you know, and from the perspective of an author who can't get a publishing contract, a literary agent is just a gatekeeper. But literary agents are also gatekeeping is their least favorite part of their job. They prefer to think of themselves as matchmakers. And their job is really to keep one foot in the field of authors and in the world of authors and to be able to communicate with authors in the language that authors use, and another foot in the world of publishers and to be able to communicate with publishers too. And their job essentially is to be translators, to take the language and the ideas that authors use and to reformulate them into a language that makes sense to publishers. One of the things that happens in this transition is that as a tool of specialization, literary agents prefer to work on books and really select books as based on books that speak to them and their own interests and their own experiences. So a literary agent with no compunction whatsoever will say, "Hey, I'm from Boston. If your story is set in Boston, I want to read your book." Or, you know, "My favorite football team or my favorite baseball team is this. So if you're writing about that, send me that book." And they winnow this oversupply of manuscripts as based on their own personal tastes. They also winnow their oversupply of manuscripts by having relationships with editors as we transition into the publishing process. So editors and agents kind of speak this blended pigeon language between two fields and are really more like each other than anybody else in this entire process. Part of this is because of the history of literary agents and that many of them used to work in publishing houses. So over 50% of literary agents in the United States got their start in book publishing. The job of the editor then is to take this enthusiasm that the literary agent has and again translate it into a language that makes sense to people in the publishing house. So an editor's job is not only to find manuscripts, but also to shepherd and parrot the manuscripts they find by a word that one of my interlocutors used was by infecting other people with enthusiasm. The editor is probably the last person before a reviewer who will actually read a full manuscript. So she really has to get other people excited and on board. She uses her enthusiasm as what I essentially argue is a form of capital. It's the sharpest arrow in her quiver to either bestow all of her enthusiasm onto a title because she wants to work on it, right? It's a way she manages her job and her autonomy to do what she wants. Or she also withholds enthusiasm if there's a lot of outside enthusiasm if a book is under auction and everybody in the industry is getting really excited about it. If she doesn't want to work on it, to manage her work life, she will selectively withhold her enthusiasm. Do you want an example here of like something that an editor did with Jarrettsville?
Absolutely.
So the editor of Jarrettsville, a young editor named Adam Kraftman, So they hired a freelance copy editor, and the freelance copy editor, after she finished copy editing the book, in a private email to Adam Kraftman said, "Oh, and by the way, you can tell the author that while copy editing the book, I cried twice." And he got a little sparkle in his eye. And his reaction wasn't to tell Cornelia Nixon that the copy editor was moved by the story, because what Cornelia Nixon thinks doesn't really matter. Instead, for the next week or so, he would just walk throughout the publishing house and share this anecdote. "Hey, got the copy edits back for Jarrettsville. The copy editor cried twice. Hey, did I mention to you that the copy editor cried twice?" Because he is strategically letting people know we might have something really special here, right? He's already been saying this, but to have this third-party evaluation, this totally unaffiliated person, a freelance copy editor, is moved to tears, is essentially for him to declare to everybody, "Let's start coordinating around this title. This is a big deal." So it's that type of enthusiasm that really makes some books travel and others not.
I mean, that enthusiasm, I think, is really interesting as you transition away from production and into reception. So you've got quite an interesting discussion of book reviews and the omerta of of the book review, which is a term I really liked, and the kind of, the closed shop of on the one hand, the kind of, you know, authorial world, but how essentially that world, you know, really shapes and is really important in determining reception. So as a transition towards questions of reception, I wonder if you could talk me through book reviews.
Yeah, so I think just as a little bit of background, I think American sociologists, when they see reviewers, they ask one question. The question they tend to ask is, they say, you know, like everybody, they say, "Oh, book reviewers are kind of intermediaries. They're brokers between production and reception." And what Americanists ask is, "Oh, that's a weird brokerage role. Are they allegiant to publishers or are they allegiant to readers? And how do they balance that allegiance?" And in a more Bourdieusian perspective, people who adhere more to the sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, they say, well, book reviewers are allegiant to each other. They want to win the battle among book reviewers to be the most prestigious and highest status book reviewer. And in the book, I say, for book publishing in particular, that's not really the case. Their allegiance falls somewhere else because of who they are. What makes book reviewing different than, let's say, film reviewing or restaurant reviewing is that the vast, vast majority of people who review books are also authors. So when you ask where their allegiances lie to other authors, not to readers, not to publishers, not to being the best book reviewer. That's just kind of a sideline activity for most of these people. But at the end of the day, the way they make sense of the world is among the world of authors. So the term I argue that best explains this is what I call author omerta. And omerta is the Sicilian mafia code of silence. So the shape that that takes is that it's pretty rare to come across exceedingly negative book reviews. Major criticisms get rewritten into faint praise. Or if an author reads a book and is supposed to review it and doesn't have anything nice to say about it, she'll just decline the review more often than not. We know, so it's in a weird way, it's this field level collusion is the term I use to talk about it. And we know this exists because of where the system doesn't take hold, right? So I have a lot of, in the book, I interview a lot of reviewer authors who are quite open that they do this and that this is just the way things are done. But it's where negative book reviews do appear that further confirms that this system really takes place. You really only see strongly negative book reviews, or I would say most frequently see strongly negative book reviews in three ways. It's when a professional reviewer who is not an author themselves reviews a book. They don't adhere to the code. That would be number one. Number two, if there's an exceptionally famous author who has written a second book, that book might get panned very harshly by another author, right? Because they actually do feel like they're doing a service to readers, where readers would read that book anyway. So the Code of Omerta is really for non-famous authors, it's a favor done for other non-famous authors. There's no point in bashing somebody in print that readers won't read anyway. As one reviewer said it, all you're doing is damage to the author's psyche. And the third place that we really see Omerta being broken is in reviews in Publishers Weekly and Kirkus. That's really important because, number one, Publishers Weekly and Kirkus are industry trade publications. Readers don't read them. And more importantly, Publishers Weekly and Kirkus are the only two venues in which reviews are anonymous. So in the book, I probably extend the metaphor a little bit too far and say we know the code of Omerta exists because among most reviewers, it's only broken in Publishers Weekly and Kirkus, which is like snitching from within the witness protection program. Nobody knows your name. Nobody knows that you're the one who did it.
It's an excellent metaphor.
Okay.
The final, I'm trying to think of the word, you know, kind of pole of the great stool that is literary publishing is readers. And you've got a couple of chapters at the end of the book on readers. And again, you know, we're talking about reviews, you know, and the kind of service to the readers and, you know, setting the kind of mood music for the reception of the book, along with all this, you know, all the stuff that the industry is doing.
Yeah.
What are some of the reactions that readers had to Jarrettsville? You know, there were, in the book you talk about it prompted discussions of race, southernness, what it means to live in the town itself, you know, and also crucially, I suppose, the kind of social location or the broader demographic characteristics that shape readers' receptions.
Absolutely, yeah. And so there's two major, so just to give a little background, so I had followed Jarrettsville through this whole process. I studied Cornelia Nixon and then I worked at the publisher while they published the book, and I followed the book out into the world of bookstores and reviewers. And then I took the novel into 21 book groups across the United States and studied people while they read it. So I have two chapters on that. And in cutesy little titles, the first chapter is called Reading Life into Novels. And the idea there is that, you know, readers show up to a novel and they have their whole lives behind them and they use their lives as a tool to make sense of what this novel is. Right. So what that means, as I find and argue, is that for readers from the South, Jarrettsville is a novel about love and loss. Right. Whereas for readers from the North, it's not really about that same thing. Readers from the South see racism in the Civil War as being hugely influential in what happens in the outcome of this story, whereas readers from the North tend to blame Martha or Nick. They see it rather than this story of structure and how it impinges on the lives of individual people. They see it really as a story of moral failings among the characters in a way that Southern readers don't. And then in the next chapter, so that chapter was reading life into novels. The next chapter flips the metaphor and it's reading novels into life. It's not that readers just take their backgrounds and imprint them onto this manuscript, Jarrettsville, but they also then take Jarrettsville and really use it as a starting point, as a catalyst to share their own experiences and talk about their own lives with each other. In book groups, all people did was talk about the book. Book groups probably wouldn't exist, right? That's not really the point of a book group. A book group uses a book as a catalyst for people to talk about each other and to share their own lives. So with Jarrettsville, because of the story itself, the contents of the story itself, while people start off talking about the novel across these 21 book groups, they then launch into making sense of their own lives, largely about romantic relationships, right? So they take Martha and Nick's relationship and start sharing with each other about their own romantic problems or feelings the book brought up in them. And then their fellow book group members talk about it and talk through these problems about backgrounds of racism or experiences with racism. You know, in this one provocative moment, a book group of Southern readers. So Richard is Martha's brother and was very likely a militia member with John Wilkes Booth in history and is just a villain. He's an awful, awful person. But this book group of Southern women then started applying this awful character to their own lives and to people they know, and they're from Nashville, Tennessee. So they talk about the history of racism in their family or relatives who they still love and who they can't not love, but who are deeply racist. And in the process, they become empathetic of Richard. They feel bad for him. They think that he, you know, like their uncle or their cousin are trapped in this masculinist code of Southern honor. So they really take the novel and also use it. It's this dialogical process of using it to make sense of their own lives and also using their own lives to make sense of the novel. And then the final part of that chapter profiles this one woman who I named Sandy, who lives in Jarrettsville, Maryland. So I spend a couple days in Jarrettsville, Maryland, studying people who live there as they read Jarrettsville. And she is part of, she is one of very few interracial families in Jarrettsville, Maryland. She's white. Her husband is African-American and her kids are biracial. And reading Jarrettsville was really somewhat traumatic for her as it dredged up the past 30 years of racism she's faced in the town. And her takeaway is like, we haven't changed. Like everything from the 1890s is still the way it is today. So for her, Jarrettsville was really a catalyst. She spent the next month trying to create book groups to talk about Jarrettsville with her as a way to introduce her experiences, and so she could feel less alone in her experiences that she's felt in the town. And the argument there is really that you know, culture isn't just something that people make sense of or just imprint their lives onto, but sometimes people also use it as a tool for action, as a way to try to change their lives and their social experiences around them.
I mean, that specter of racism brings us into the conclusion where you explicitly engage with inequalities, which is interesting because I think one of the things the book does really well is almost kind of take at face value the things that the different constituencies in the process of producing the novel say. So, you know, you talk about how editors legitimize their decisions by talking about their tastes, and you mentioned, you know, agents and they're kind of like, you know, well, I'm from Boston, blah, 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 you know, this kind of stuff. And then, you know, the payoff to the book is actually, this is a highly socially stratified and structured set of fields. And there are really obvious inequalities. And, you know, one of them is around race and the effective, you know, kind of exclusion of those who don't fit a particular norm of being, you know, affluent white people who dominate publishing.
Yeah, you know, so I think we can think about this in two different ways. I think we can think about the demographics of it, and I think we can think about the culture of it. And I think you really need both sides of that to make sense of it and to make any policy prescriptions. You know, I think you and I might be in a little bit of agreement that we sometimes treat we substitute in everything we want for just demographics, right? So in this case, the demographics really do matter. So for literary agents, we can talk about is, you know, quote unquote, gatekeepers to the world of book publishing. In the United States, according to my data, 3% of literary agents in the United States are Black or Latino. In 2015, there were two Black male literary agents that I could find in the entire United States. Since then, more might have come, but I can say for certain that those two have left the industry. And because of how literary agents do their job, that ends up being massively consequential. So with quantitative data, I can show that white literary agents, which are about 96% of literary agents in the United States, are much less likely to be willing to represent works of ethnic or multicultural fiction, which are code words for literary fiction with non-white main characters, than are non-white literary agents. And there's a big mismatch between this underrepresentation of literary agents and readers for literature, people who self-report high rates of reading literature for pleasure in the United States. So we have about 3% of Black or Latino literary agents in the United States, whereas over 20% of people in the United States who read literature for pleasure are Black and Latino. That really matters because of the cultural component, because literary agents are selecting manuscripts as based on their own experiences. In my interviews and observations of literary agents, they're more diverse in their reading practice when not at work than when at work, right? And their personal reading habits, like many people, they read to inhabit the lives of people unlike themselves. But when working, part of doing good work is to specialize in the things that are most familiar to you. This gets replicated with editors also. So the question is, what do you do about this? Is that kind of where we're going with this? I just want to make sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, it really is the obvious question that I guess, you know, kind of the book poses at the end. You know, you could read this system as, you know, quite benign. You know, it means that, you know, some authors get to have a living and they get social status, publishing, you know, broadly speaking, works for those within it. But there are just these, you know, kind of crucial social exclusions as soon as you ask any kind of demographic questions.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so because it's interdependent, you know, the obvious policy prescription that people always give is, well, we need more diversity. And I don't want to diminish that. That's absolutely true. But I think it's also worth focusing on what happens with the diverse representations we do have. So in the book, I talk about, I interview a lot of authors of color, non-white authors, Black and Latino, and Asian authors. And they really find themselves, first of all, is one now somewhat famous author, a Black fiction, nonfiction writer and memoirist told me, he said, we're aware of who the editors are. It's not like we don't know. And so he finds himself really trapped having to write towards these acquisition editors who he knows don't share his experience. So he says, I'm like fighting in my mind, trying to synthesize what I know is true about these characters that I'm writing with how I know I need to convey them to acquisition editors who don't have any familiarity or personal experience with the characters like the ones I'm writing about. Right. Many non-white authors talk about to get published, it's almost like you have to whitewash or rewrite your story into a way that makes sense to people who don't share that social milieu. And then when you get to the marketing and publicity and promotion stage, the reverse happens, right? And things get pitched as like not being anything more than a story about people who aren't white. So as a Asian American writer who had just written a short story collection said, she went to her publisher when they were at the cover design stage and she said, like, you can do anything you want with the cover, but please just don't put any fireworks on it. Like, please just don't put any lanterns on it. These are stories about people. I know they're Chinese American people, but they are stories about people. So the publisher put goldfish on the cover, right? And as she said, it's the only thing I left them,
yeah.
So regretfully, right? So I do think we need to focus on increasing diversity within these fields, but we also need to focus on the lives of experiences of people from diverse backgrounds who are already there. You know, I think a really important statistic that's worth sharing is according to Publishers Weekly Salary Survey Data, which is the most robust survey data of this industry, white editors, their most frequent job complaint is that they feel overworked, right? For non-white editors, their most frequent job complaint is they think they have a lack of opportunity for advancement. Right. Non-white book publishing professionals are significantly more likely to say they plan on leaving the industry. So it's not just to say we just need to diversify can almost it's both an easy answer and a simple answer and an answer that is this kind of like binary. Well, we just need to do this one thing and then all our problems are solved. And that's really not the case, even for folks from diverse backgrounds. In the industry, they too are experiencing inequality and they're leaving the industry because of it. I think another concern, and this will be the last point here, is that just diversifying the workforce isn't enough. That hopefully soon to come diverse workforce, it's worth saying also that the publishing industry in the United States isn't any more diverse than it was 25 to 30 years ago. The Association of American Publishers did a diversity survey in the late 1970s, and they had the same rate of diversity that was found in 2016, right? So this narrative of things always getting better, probably not that accurate. In addition to this diversity of workforce, you editors need to be given the same autonomy, the same tools to use enthusiasm to get their way that editors still exhibit today. So we can imagine a scenario with an incredibly diverse workforce of literary agents and editors, but in which that autonomy in making decisions is stripped away, that diversity of representation isn't going to change anything. So you really need that culture of autonomy of really trusting editors and letting editors manage what they do and what books they work on plus diversifying the workforce of editors at the same time. That's the key.
Is that the kind of thing that you're going to be doing, I guess, kind of next, you know, in terms of the intellectual project following the book? Or, you know, is it time for something completely different?
Yeah, so that is one of the things I'm doing. So I'm still looking into those questions really deeply, the details of which I don't want to go into too much because it involves a bit of experimental design, but I'm looking at that. I'm getting more deeply into the relationship between sociodemographics and interpersonal influence in book clubs and what is really kind of driving the story there. I think as sociologists, we lean incredibly hard on sociodemographics as the way that people make sense of things. And the early and the premonitions or the findings I'm getting from this data show that that's not the case. So before the book groups talked to each other, men and women didn't read Jarrettsville any differently from each other. There wasn't a male or a female reading of Jarrettsville. But what happened is then because people self-segregate in book groups into people like themselves, women would get together to meet and talk about Jarrettsville, and men would get together to meet and talk about Jarrettsville. There were one or two mixed gender book groups too. And after the book groups, you see what you think are these huge gender differences in what the story means, but that's just kind of an after effect of the fact that women all talked to each other. It wasn't a female reading. It was all these women happened to get in a room together or chose to get in a room together, and they create a female reading in the process. So I'm looking at that. And then, you know, for our next project, I knew I wanted to study something all the way through. And at the time, out of fear, I didn't study the thing I wanted to study. I've always loved fiction, and I decided to study fiction because a lot of people write about book publishing. But I'm really excited to kind of take this model that I've proposed and constructed and take it to another cultural field and really try to break it. You know, I don't think there's any point in making an argument about a better way we should be doing things unless you're willing to try to break it yourself. So I think I want to port this same idea into another cultural arena and prove myself wrong is really what I'm looking to do.
Thanks for listening to New Books and Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Clayton Childress about his new book, Under the Cover, The Creation, Production and Reception of a Novel.